This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 12th of November, 1951. The title of this lecture is Prime Thought. This lecture is 68 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
Well, I want to tell you about an emotional curve. The individual, the personality, handles the physical body with an action relay system, glands, endocrine system. The endocrine system is monitored, evidently, by the individual himself, or that part of the individual which is his own center of awareness. In other words, the awareness of awareness of an individual handles the physical action, records physical action through an emotional relay system. It's a very interesting system. It's not very complex, actually, but the compounds in it are very complex. It took life an awful long time to tailor up and square around all of the various types of compounds which go to make up such things as thyroid, testosterone, estrogen, adrenaline, etc., etc. These compounds, by the way, can be injected into animals which have not developed that gland and produce the same result. You get the idea. I mean, you take some adrenaline if you're dealing with mobile bacteria, which obviously doesn't have such a gland and so forth, and you get a catalytic action on it. In other words, this stuff affects the stuff life uses to form bodies. Endocrine system. Well, we have then three levels of operation. We have first thought, which is thought on the basis of awareness. A person says to himself so and so, does so and so and so and so. Everything in thought is preceded by physical action. In other words, before there's a thought, there has to be a physical contact with the physical universe. Except one thought. That's prime thought. Now, it's the first thought. And then everything succeeds this first thought. So we call this thing prime thought. It doesn't depend upon physical action. It doesn't have anything to do with the prime mover unmoved. It's just prime thought. Person thinks a thought. And that thought is a very specific thought. And it is merely the thought to be. He thinks, I will be. And he is. All right. There is a second thought, which is, but does not have to be, all by itself, and that is, I will not be. Now, thinking is categorized in these brackets. I will be, I will not be. In other words, a person assumes the state of beingness or steps away from the state of beingness. And the whole cycle of life is simply this cycle. I will be, it goes along, something happens, I will not be. And as a result, you get this curve. The funny part of it is that prime thought does not just begin at the beginning of track on the genetic line. Prime thought can happen at any time. It can happen at any time that a person, without cause, reason, or anything else, can suddenly say, I will be. And is. That is the one independent thought. The other one is more or less dependent upon other things because the thought, I will be, is so natural that to fall away from it is not quite as natural since it denotes failure. A person then at any time could say, I will not be. Just totally independent of anything. I mean, in this particular super-controlled age, we have been instructed into the idea that it's all stimulus response, that we see something happen in the environment and then we do so-and-so. Oh, no, we don't. A person who is aberrated almost to the point of insanity does that. Stimulus response mechanism. Actually, let's say he has an engram that tells him to do something or other, and something happens in the environment, and it re-stimulates the engram. Well, believe me, it re-stimulates the engram on this pattern. Well, there is something in the environment. Oh, yes. I think I will let that remind me of something or other, and you shove a theta facsimile at it, and there you are. The whole process of re-stimulation has in it this intermediary step of saying, I'll do that. And even though it's very swift, it's still there. It is not just automatic, it's just become condensed in time. Because it's become a part of almost any engram which has been permitted to re-stimulate. In other words, an individual at any time on his own free will can suddenly say, I will be. I'm sure there are very few people here who have not had the experience being all dragged out and knocked down, and life has walked all over them, and they got footprints on them, and they've been sick for a long time, and all of a sudden, without any associative reasons whatsoever, they suddenly say, well, I will be. They suddenly stop being sick and start being effective and start accomplishing things and going out along the line. Fantastic. Just suddenly, I will be. Well, you can say, I won't be at the same time. This happened to people in the service quite often. They'd look at all these second lieutenants that were fresh graduated out of Vassar, and they'd say, well, I won't be. And they'd stop being. After the war was over, most of them neglected to say again, I will be. And so they stay in sort of a state of, not quite pleased with life. Life looks to them a little bit trying. Anybody who has been in the service, by the way, just postulate this for no good reason at all. Just say, well, I'll be again. Stop being once, now I'll be again. Bang. That is thinking a prime thought. It doesn't carry with it any vast strain or strenuousness or anything of the sort, because that's when you start to add effort into it. All right, there's that echelon. This does accumulation of data, computation, and so forth. Now the next one down is the way that thought and self-determinism subjugates the body to put it into the required activity. And it does this with the endocrine system. And it's got a little motor switchboard somewhere in the body. And it just says, well, so-and-so, arms and legs move, and so forth. Now, it doesn't, on the principle of pulling wires on a puppet, move the arms and legs. What it does is level endocrine catalysts into the motor areas. For instance, this whole pituitary in here has about 47 known parts which act as various catalysts of various sorts. Now, thought it's very easy, you see, to touch a little tiny electronic button and blow up an atom bomb. Well, on the same principle, awareness of awareness has enough contact so that it can turn on, by this theory, an endocrine activity, positive or negative. It can say withdraw, it can say charge, it can say do anything, it can say leg move to the right, it can say hands be graceful. Any one of these things can be monitored by an endocrine system. All right. The next level down is, of course, the level of actual physical action, of effort. This is the muscle that swells up. This is your hands go out and move something. It's very quick by our frame of reference. By the way, to show you that this is very self-determined, there is such a system, there is nothing you can alter faster than your reaction time in Dianetics. You can really alter that in a hurry. Now, here are these three levels. This second level has been relatively neglected until very recently because couldn't figure any way to get a purchase on it. There are various thoughts and experiments were tried, and finally the answer rolled out, and it was so simple that of course it was missed. Too simple. And that is the fact that the emotional reactions of the past can be very easily and simply contacted by contacting the curve of change, by giving the person comparison of one emotional state with another emotional state in the same period of time. A person gets an awareness of time itself, since time is known to us through change. So as a result, you can run the emotional curve on an individual. I don't think you'll have any pre-clears who can't find that emotional curve in one bracket or another. It's very easy to locate. Before I tell you exactly what it is, let me tell you first about the cycle of action. Life always attempts to complete a cycle of action. And by the way, this is very, very interesting in human behavior. Regardless of what kind of a cycle of action is begun, life tries to complete it. Now, the basic cycle of action, of course, is conception, birth, growth, level, decay, death. I mean, there's that cycle of action. That's the big cycle of action, as far as one lifetime is concerned. Now, you can see a cycle of action that way. We have to look a little closer to see these second cycles of action. They're little fellas. Fella says, I'm going to be a streetcar conductor. Says this when he's five. He started a cycle of action when he said that. He'll go around, he'll play being a streetcar conductor for a while and then, quote, forget about it. One day, he's about 40, and he's riding along, and he said, gee, it would be fun to drive this streetcar. I wonder how you would go about it. I wouldn't be a bit surprised, but what, maybe Princess Elizabeth merely postulated one of these things just so that, and just got to be princess just so that she could run that train up in Canada a short time ago. I mean, it's that silly. I mean, these cycles of action can be that foolish. A person says he's going to do something, and come hell or high water, he will. But he starts cycle of action after cycle of action after cycle of action without finishing them, and then wonders why he's confused at the time he's about 35 or 40. He's pretty cluttered up by that time. He has started 8,667 cycles of action each year he's been alive, and he's finished maybe one of them, leaving an unfinished quota which would take him many, many lifetimes to complete. All you have to do in processing is get an individual to remember when he started one of these cycles of action, and the impulse to finish it will slow up. Now, this is very dangerous on such a level as suicide. A person starts the cycle of action by saying, I'm going to kill myself. He started a cycle of action right there. He'll go along for years trying to complete this action until he finally sees a psychoanalyst and kills himself. Didn't you know that was what they were for? Now, that's a very dangerous cycle of action, though. All right. There are other cycles of action. Person starts in school, in high school, says, I'm going to be a teacher. I want to be a teacher. He's met a teacher he likes very much. I want to be a teacher. He goes along through college. By the time he gets to college, he's forgotten about this. Forgotten, unquote. And then gets out into life, and the next thing you know,
has made a very successful business building trucks. And there's only one thing they don't like at him about him down at the plant is he's always coming down the production line showing them how. He's trying to complete that cycle of action. He said he's going to be a teacher, so he's stuck with it. Now, there are two things that happen to a cycle of action. They succeed or they fail. A person starts a cycle of action, and if he starts it in earnest and it fails, at the moment of its failure, he has to pick up an explanation of why he failed, and he will pick up at that moment a facsimile and offer it to the world, himself, and so forth. People used to come around to me when I was a brash young writer. Writers take themselves very seriously, particularly when they're very young. It used to just drive me crazy. I had put in years pounding a typewriter. All the time I was studying everything else, I was still pounding this typewriter, keeping myself alive and so forth, and the daily bread, and it's quite a business, writing is. And it has nothing to do with the American university. The American universities ruin about 280,000 writers a year. That's how many ABs they graduate. They ruin them because they teach them that one has to be taught how to write. And the second that a writer says, all right, I agree to be taught, he has given up all of his rights as an artist, because the act of being an artist says, I know. That is self-confidence. I know. And as soon as he says, I have to be taught before I know, what he has to do actually is go on counterfeiting that he knows until he does know. You'll find most brash people will do this. People used to come up to me and say, well, I would have written too, except that I never could get to college. I used to go nuts on this. I mean, all you had to do was study and then get to be a writer. I felt very defeated about the whole thing, because it was my belief that writing was a talent. I find out it's nothing more nor less now than self-confidence and ability to use the English language. Very few people are allowed to. What talent there is, I don't know. When I was a little kid, I used to have to get out of a lot of things by telling a flock of lies, and I thought this was the training which later on let me write fiction. But anyhow, people would come around and they would tell me about this incomplete cycle of action. When they were in high school, they wanted to be a writer. Now, they go into apathy about existence. Listen, every time they start a cycle of action, they'll go into apathy if they don't finish it. You wonder why you've got an apathetic populace, because all of these postulates, one after the other, beginning these cycles of action, are laid down, fail, laid down, fail, laid down, fail. And if you fail enough, you're in apathy. Because every time you fail, you have to explain it to the world, and that means that you have to pick up some past experience or deficiency, something of the sort. You pass the signboard, you say, I couldn't see it, my eyes are bad. You send in a story to the editor, and the editor sends the story back, and he says, nothing, it's just a printer rejection slip. And you say, well, it's because the paper was wrong, or it's because he's mean. Of course, you don't dare say the story isn't good enough. As a matter of fact, you don't dare say the story is not good enough. You can say, well, I can do much better. But even this is a sort of a little admission that you failed, because you didn't do your best before. So the best and easiest and fastest way out of it is to say, well, I was tired the day I wrote that. You know, it's tired. Typing is tiring, you say. After that, you sit down to a typewriter, you get tired. I mean, it's very simple. These things are so simple. All of this is so simple that it's been most fantastically overlooked. Nobody under the sun dared take this square look at the physical universe and say, gee, I was guilty. I did it to myself. In Dianetics, after all of this tremendous amount of research, I have to get pretty well up the tone scale and so forth before I take a look at it. And it's pretty grim. Pretty grim. I remember the first day I took a look at this, I went down into apathy. I mean went into apathy. It worked out by extrapolation. It figured out mathematically that self-determinism both existed and was the cause and reason of. Oh, no. And I sat around all one afternoon with hardly enough energy to move my right toe. I was so apathetic. Then I started going back and picking it up, and all of a sudden I started to feel good because a lot of points that had been missed along the lines in pre-clears and in auditing in general and so forth were suddenly revealed to view, and at one solid slash, perhaps 99% of the auditing time necessary to resolve a case had been knocked away. All right, this is a cycle of action. Cycle of action generally starts out on a fairly high level. It starts out on the level of, I will, or I do. Bang, hi, I will be, in other words. Enthusiastic, determined, no sense of failure, no doubt of existence, or anything of that sort. Starts out high. Now all of a sudden, you trip over the first rope that's laid across the path. You know, they say no society's ethics is ever higher than the moment when it is formed. Well, there's reasons for this. Same way with this cycle of action. Cycle of action dwindles, that doesn't increase, unless it gets processed in the meantime. And you see, you can slicker the whole thing now. You can keep a cycle of action going on with greater and greater horsepower because all you do is keep knocking out the failures and leaving the successes intact. And the first thing you know, you're 9.4 feet tall. All right, here starts the cycle of action. The person says, I am going to be. And then a little doubt, a little failure. Tremendous effort in here to struggle out of this somehow, and then recognition of, I don't believe I can do it. See, and that's awful. That's terrible. That's doubt comes in there, and then all of a sudden, I didn't do it. Actually, a person isn't even down the tone scale at all until he says he is. And he says to himself suddenly, I failed. I observe physical evidence around me that tells me I have failed. Oh, boy. That's death. You see, the cycle of action of life is to come into existence and live till you're dead. And so here's this little cycle of action. So the failure says dead. How wrong can you be? Dead. Very simple. All right, so you start out this cycle of action, bong. Now, usually, that failure has to be explained, but it has to be explained for this reason. I'm dead, but I'm not dead. My heart's still beating, I failed. And by the way, you'll find this very evident if you take a person back down the time track. You'll find these points of failure, and there's where he goes out of valence. There's where he dies. Right there. Now, as an excuse for still being alive, he has to pick up one of these service facsimiles and see it. Say, I'm alive, but I'm very sick. See? Dermatitis. Pick up that postulate. I don't want dermatitis. Anyhow, the point is that a person will coast through an illness ordinarily after such thing, or a mental disturbance, no matter how, well, because of how normal he is. He goes through this mental disturbance and will continue in a fairly disturbed fashion to the end, beginning of the next cycle, which is the end of the present cycle. In other words, he will come uphill through a recovery or something of the sort and then hit this new high. That is generally because he has met up with a new ally. He's made an ally out of something. So an auditor should pick up the whole curve from beginning to end. And at the beginning of the dive, he will find the first small failures. At the bottom of it, he will find the major failure. At the end of this curve, the bottom of the slope, he will find an illness. And at the top of the next hump, we'll find an ally. It is so mathematical, I'm ashamed of myself. Here's your cycle of action. here's up here, big activity, here's your beginning of small failures, doubts, major failures, then all of a sudden, big failure, die. Now this is up here around maybe 4, something like that, and this is really about 0. There's an instant where a person will go into pretended death on the recognition of a failure. Even if it's just if they just sit still, all of a sudden they recognize they failed at something, they just go. You ever see a person who suddenly realized he failed? He just relaxes. He dies. And then he comes to life a moment later when you speak to him. All right, so he comes along here, and here's a period of varying maybe illness or something of the sort. Now he starts uphill, and up here you'll find a new ally. You want to know why you've never been able to find Grandma in some case or other? It's because Grandma always appeared at this top line. And you couldn't get at the top line until you got this curve out of the rope. Now, it's very easy to get an individual to find this curve. As a matter of fact, you sitting right there can remember a time when you were happy and then you felt sad. When something happened to you in a certain period of time, you first felt happy, you were feeling all right, and then something happened, you felt sad. Somebody made a smart crack. Anything like that. That's a little curve. Now, you can find that curve. You can get your pre-clear to re-experience that curve. He spots the moment and you get him to re-experience it. And then go over it a few times. The most astonishing things will come out. Because all you're getting him to re-experience is the emotional curve. And you're not getting him to experience a difficult emotion like grief or fear. Although he'll pass through those stages on his curve, you're asking him the time when he was happy and a time when he felt rather apathetic. That is success and failures, all right? Happy, apathetic, happy again. And when you get him young and back into his early youth, you'll find out that he's happy, sad, sick. Enough. And there is the establishment of your facsimile pattern. And there is the emotional facsimile pattern. Now it so happens that these engrams are hooked in and contain this emotional curve. And if you take the emotional curve off of them, they go by the boards. You don't have to work their effort. And if you can't find the thought right away in them, just work the emotional curve engrams for a while. And all of a sudden the postulates will start turning up. It is just like opening up a magic bag of tricks as far as an auditor is concerned. Here is an emotional curve. The person's, you just give him this, and he finds it maybe, well, yes, somebody, Josie, called me a liar 3 days ago, all right. Let's see if we can find the period where she did. Now, we're not concentrating on anything but the emotion, all right. You're feeling all right, you're discussing something, and all of a sudden you were called a liar. How'd you feel then? Well, let's see if we can go over that a few times. Can we find an earlier time? Now he's all of a sudden got the whole bank open on this subject. Well, he doesn't realize it yet. All of a sudden, you take him back just a few days, and he'll find another one. You'll find another one. You'll find another one. Find another one. And first thing you know, he's walked right into the service facsimile. Right into it. And again, really, all you have to take off of a service facsimile is its emotional curve. Now, that leads in then to all that a person is using to keep others away from him or himself in line or something of the sort. That's all he's using. He has self-determined something, some cycle of action. Then the cycle of action failed. Then he picked up a reason why it failed. And then he comes back up the track when somebody else comes along or something else comes along to pick him up. And if you run that emotional curve on a case just over and over many, many times, you'll find them starting to shed all their service facsimiles. They shed it fast. Now, it is so easy to find emotion. Sometimes you will not get the bottom curve. Maybe there are other curves on this. Maybe the case is terribly occluded. Well, you can find something on that case. Let's run sympathy. Sympathy. Every time you ever felt sympathetic for anyone on any dynamic, for yourself, for kids, for dogs, for groups, for the starving Armenians they used to get you to eat food by telling you about, and so on and so on, all the way along the line. Any of these things, any sympathy. You see, sympathy is pretty low-tone stuff. You can kill a man with sympathy. Sympathy runs from 0.9 to 0.4, way down at the bottom of the tone scale. Even the medical profession knew this. It's an awfully simple fact. It's a primer. Now, the medical profession found out that there are three methods of treatment. One, you could do something for a man's ills if you could. Or you could or you could make him comfortable. That was the second echelon of treatment. You couldn't do anything to cure him. You could make him comfortable. And the last one, the last resort, was to give him sympathy. There's something very funny about sympathy. Sympathy is just what it says. It says, I am you. You start going around feeling sympathy for dogs that are limping, you're liable to start limping. You start feeling sympathetic for poor mama's bunions, mama having to work so hard all day and sweating over a hot cook stove, and nobody is nice to her, nobody appreciates it, and your little kid there about 6, 7, you say, poor mama, if I could only do something for my mother, only do something for her, if I could only show her that I mean, make life easier, I will grow up and be a millionaire and make $1 million and give her $1 million, 1-1. That whole thing is 1-1. It isn't cute. It's terribly aberrative. Terribly aberrative. You get some 1-5 mother, she'll keep laying it into the kids. Well, when I'm old and gray and dead, you'll certainly appreciate me then. I work so hard, nobody cares. Nobody cares anything about me. I am a martyr to my task. Here I work all day over a scalding hot washing machine, and there you are out playing. You never even bother to help me. The next reaction is, please. The kid gets all broken down. He realizes he's done something bad, and we get the anatomy of sympathy. Maybe you've never looked at this anatomy before.
But it's hideous.
Here you are at 1-5. Sympathy is at 1-1. Propitiation, covert hostility, and so forth. Down here is grief, 0-5. All right. You're feeling perfectly happy here, and somebody says something to you, or does something to you, or takes something of yours that brings you down here. Now you do something. You take an action, or you say something. And it hurts them. And you right away go down. You may not think it until you look it over in your own mind. But every time you have ever felt sympathy for anyone, it was because you had just got through being awfully mean and nasty to them. What's the mechanism? Here's Joe Blow. You say to Joe, you think you're so good looking, you ought to be ugly or something of the sort. Yak, 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 any kind of an insult. And all of a sudden he feels crushed by the thing. He really goes into a decline on this. You think to yourself, I shouldn't have said that. Poor Joe. You just handed out a service facsimile, regardless of, you didn't know whether where it came from or why you picked it up, but you had it. And you threw it at him. Do not send to find for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. Any action that you take on any dynamic will recoil on you the moment it fails even slightly. And you see, you fail if he fails. So that if you can take a successful curve of action, let's say you start out to win over Joe Blow, and if you can go along and really win, you're in fine shape. But don't try to take a dirty, underhanded, unethical 1/5 theta facsimile of something that's been done to you and hand it along to him. Because if he caves in on it, you get it back. Bang, just automatically, and you go into sympathy, and then you're Joe Blow. Grim. Really terribly grim. You start examining a pre-clear and you say, I notice that you sometimes exhibit a little embarrassment. Who did you want to feel embarrassed? Oh, no. My Aunt Sousaphone. She always used to get into restaurants and scream. I used to feel very embarrassed for her. You even get the terminology we have in the language. It describes the action. I used to feel embarrassed for her. Well, did you ever accomplish anything by feeling embarrassed for her? No. No. Of course, that was an action which failed. So you got it. There's your pre-clear feeling embarrassed. They wanted Aunt Susie to feel embarrassed, so they felt embarrassed. You get the idea. All right. Now that interplay, you'll find little kids wishing their grown-ups around them were blind or being tortured to death or almost anything, and then one day the kid fails in some overt action in that direction, and boom! His cycle of action is to get back what he set out. Now, we could read some terrifically nice, quiet, moral lectures into this. But there's only one lecture which I wish you would read into it. Don't fail! Now, a point about this, if you go out and you see a deer galumphing along, beautiful deer, and you want that venison, and you lift your rifle to the shoulder, and you drill that deer right straight through the brain pan, and it takes one bound into the air, falls dead. You go over and cut up the deer and pack it home, he feels fine. What would happen? What would happen to you, emotionally perhaps, if after you'd shot the deer, you found out you'd missed, and the deer was dragging 1 foot along and bleating piteously, and at this moment maybe you saw the fawn coming along after the deer, and it's looking for its mama, and this poor deer is completely ruined, and now you have nothing to do but kill it out of mercy. Pretty messy. The whole point is don't miss. Yeah, that's it. Don't mis-evaluate your efforts. If you think to go on surviving, you've got to put somebody out of action, put them out of action. Don't mess around with it. Don't nag at them. Because you'll wind up down here on the toaster. And then somebody will have to come along and spend 45 minutes or an hour processing all this stuff out of your life. And daylight's burning. I mean, we don't have time to do that. All right, anyhow, if you go back and pick up all the sympathy you had for your father, all the sympathy you had for your mother, all the sympathy you had for Aunt Bessie, right then you'll probably feel like you're about 8 and 2.5 tall. Just pick up this emotion of feeling sorry for. You can recover it. Right this minute, if I ask you, when in your life did you do something bad that you felt sorry for immediately afterwards? And the person in this room, I don't think it has. What was destructive is that feeling sorry for it afterwards, because that shifted valence for you. That put you over and nailed you down at that level of the tone scale on an emotional basis. And all you have to pick out of it is just the emotion of being sympathetic, that's all. Now you start picking out the number of times you felt sorry for somebody, and the next thing you know, you'll start running into the times when you felt agreement with certain things that you didn't want to feel agreement with. Well, it's way down at the bottom of the tone scale, too. Feeling agreement with somebody that you don't want to agree with. That's holding yourself in line. And it's an emotion. A-R-C, these things are emotions. The feeling of talking to somebody you didn't want to talk to. The emotion of doing that. Get your pre-clear to re-experience that. You'll find out it's a curve, too. He'll start out at this level. He's feeling perfectly happy. Somebody shows up and starts talking to him. See? just work on sympathy all by yourself, and you're going to pick up more postulates of things you've postulated in the past. Because this sympathy has got it all masked. It's dropped the curtain on it. What did you really think about the situation? The sympathy there, guilt, recrimination, all the rest of this sort of stuff slopping around, it'll stop you from picking up your own thought on the subject. You start picking up your own free thought on the subject, you find out you wish it all on yourself anyway, and it'll blow. Now, this sympathy, remember, goes on all dynamics, and that includes you. When have you felt sorry for your eyes? When have you felt sorry for your mouth, for your legs, for yourself? Anyway, what's the emotion of feeling sorry for yourself? You know, you can take a great big beautiful ship that's been groomed up and paid for twice as much as it's worth by taxpayers' money, manned by officers and gentlemen by act of Congress. Take this big beautiful ship, give it everything it needs, but give it a captain who's sorry for his crew, who doesn't want to hurt them. Oh. Why not just take her out and sink her? Why not just run her out on a reef someplace and rip the bottom out of her and let her go to the bottom peacefully instead of becoming a hell ship for every man aboard her? Because that's what happens. He's afraid to hurt somebody. And the next thing you know, he's hurt everybody so desperately that they're like to die. Because this is actually another method of revenge, no matter what else you call it. Too low in the con down there to be anything else. Remember, you can kill people by feeling sorry for them. You see somebody walking down the street and you suddenly start talking to him as though you felt sorry for him, you'll have him dragging the gutters. If he doesn't know Dianetics. Terrible weapons we put in new people's hands. Here's this captain of the ship. He feels sorry for everybody. He doesn't want anybody to be in bad shape. He sympathizes with everybody that comes in. And the next thing you know, all the authority of his petty officers is gone. All the authority of his various department heads is gone. All the pride of the crew in themselves is gone. The guns start to go to pieces. The ship starts to store wrong. Everybody feels sorry for himself if he has to do any work. And one fine day, everybody's feeling so desperately sorry for themselves, they sink it anyhow. The process of saving person after person's feelings, of never telling them the truth, of always avoiding it with a social lie or something of the sort, is a form of cowardice. It's here on the tone scale. It's much better to say to somebody, you know, I'm mad as hell at you, than to say, oh yes, I think you're just swell, and then tell somebody on his aside or do something aside that's going to wreck them. Because that's what a person at that position, the tone scale, does. All right, we talk about a naval vessel where the captain feels sorry for everyone. Let's talk about you and your awareness of awareness unit in your own body. Your body's made to be used. You as a living organism are made to be pitched into the cauldron of action and committed to the adventures of the business of living. And when I say pitched into, I mean pitched. Because there was no adventure worth going into unless your intent in going into it was to give it everything you had. And the second you stop living like that, happens to you just like it happens to the naval vessel. You might as well go run yourself aground. You're going to get diffident, scared of this, cautious about that, figuring this way, doing this. You get sick. You sit around and you say, my poor legs. My poor legs. Poor me. I got my beautiful back all sunburned. No kidding. You can start feeling this way on that band, on the tone scale, about yourself, and you can practically destroy yourself. And it's a funny thing that the parts of the body act just like individuals. There are various nerve centers which act as sub-brains in the body. And you start feeling sorry for one of those sub-brains and it starts going all to pieces. How do you feel sorry for it? You wish a facsimile off on it. The way it first happens is that maybe Mama burned your hand and then you said, look what you did to me. You see, you were wrong. The next thing you know, why, it's the hand that gets the facsimile. And the next thing you know, you got dermatitis. Or you got some sort of a chronic somatic like lumbago or something of the sort, and you're gimping around with lumbago and you're feeling sorry for yourself about having to gimp around with lumbago. You know how you can clear it up? You just go back and find the times when you were sorry for somebody who limped and sorry for you for having limped. Sympathy toward anyone else who limped. Sympathy toward yourself. What sympathy have you felt toward somebody, for instance, who wore glasses? What sympathy? And what sympathy have you felt for yourself for having to wear glasses? And out of that sympathy will suddenly turn up your postulates, because it's the easiest part of the engram to run. The easiest part of the facsimiles to run is that sympathy curve. And you run that sympathy curve, the postulates turn right up out of it very easily. Nothing much to it. So when you get balked on a case and you can't find the engrams readily, you start running the emotional curves in the case. You can generally go from there straight into emotions. And you don't have to run emotion with great drama. It can be run very lightly, actually, and very effectively. I want to tell you about a very special emotion that you're all subject to and didn't know it. Horrible thing. It turned up by just figuring if these other things are true, then this one is true, and let's try it out, and it, on being tried out, works. Determinism itself is an emotion. You start monitoring, making yourself do things, and you monitor it with a certain endocrine combination which sums under the word of determination. And it's aberrative as the devil. It probably isn't very necessary. There probably isn't any reason for you to grind your right heel into the ground every time you determine to spit. There probably is no reason for this at all. There probably is no reason at all why you should grit your teeth or stick your tongue when you use a pencil. But you see, that shows determination. All right, what is the emotion that permits you to go into such actions to demonstrate determination? Did you ever look determined for somebody else's benefit? All right, what emotion do you use to turn that thing on? And this is actually an emotion. It's fairly well down the tone scale. It's probably around 3, somewhere in there. I'm not quite sure where it is. But believe me, you can find it. And when you find it, your chronic somatic is going to have things happen to it. Because after you determined to have this thing, then you went into a long, long lifetime of determination not to have it. And every determination that you made to see in spite of your glasses was against a determination not to see. And there you are. So if you just run the determination to see, what is the emotion of determination? Well, run these emotional curves a few times first to find out what that emotional curve is, to find out what emotion is. And then you will find periods in your life when you were being determined. Now, if you have arthritis, for instance, you're determined you're going to get rid of this arthritis, you see? And you're going to find a way to get rid of this arthritis. You're determined about it. You turn on this emotion, and the next thing you know, the arthritis starts getting worse, 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 worse. You're pouring determination into it. And it, use that determination to come back at you, because you're validating it. You're feeding it its own determination. You can't just suddenly say, well, I will no longer have these facsimiles. You can say all of a sudden to yourself, I will be, and let all the rest of this go hang. You can say that and you'll recover just by laying aside your whole past suddenly. But if you're determined that you're going to get rid of something, or determined that you're going to be something or do something or something of the sort, this is an emotion. And it can be run as an emotion. Now, you'll find out normally in preachers, when you first start to run it, their favorite expression of self-determinism will show up. The favorite expression. Something like that. You don't want the muscular effort. Dickens with the muscular effort on this line. Just get the emotion of being determined about it. And the first thing you know, more postulates will start to fall out. You take somebody... Take somebody who is interested in building things, builds houses or something of the sort, and he goes out, he's got a bunch of workmen and they're all working for him, and they're not working very fast. And if they don't work fast, he's going to lose money. All right, so he stands around determining that they work fast. This hasn't anything to do with what they actually will do. He'll be very determined about it, too. He'll look at him, he'll want him to pick up those boards a little faster. He may go over and say so, but he'll fall back and he'll look at them picking up those boards. And he'll be determining them to pick up those boards. He is under the idea, true or false, that he can inflict theta facsimiles on them in some fashion or other to make them move fast. And, of course, they don't move any faster, which makes him fail. And this emotion of determinism is sown from the beginning of one's life to the end of it with failures. With failures. You go out, you're determined you're going to get the car. If the car doesn't start, you're determined you're going to get the car started. So you determine the car gets started, doesn't start, and you have to call for the service station. It comes up and fixes it, and you didn't start it. You're stuck with that one. That's a failure. And these things multiply on and on and on. Now, every time you postulated a cycle of action, somewhere along that line you became determined that you would carry it forward. A person who doesn't have this emotion of determinism, who isn't monitoring himself, has no persistence. But a person who has continually postulated and continually felt the emotion that he absolutely had to do it, determination as an emotion, failed, even though he was really succeeding, this emotion occasionally will break down into a failure. And he will come out one fine day and it won't monitor anymore by self-determinism. He's got the switchboard so jammed up with this emotion in so many quantities, with so many failures, that it just doesn't work on a self-determined basis anymore. So what he has to do, all he has to do is just swamp up all the times he was determined and it becomes a free emotion. You know that your ability to feel pleasure is an emotion. You can run this. You can simply run it on the basis of every time you felt pleasure. Just as the emotion. Hardly bother with the perceptics or anything. But just feel these, and all of a sudden you become more capable of feeling pleasure. Isn't that interesting? Become more capable of feeling pleasure. It isn't because you re-stimulated the flock of pleasure incidents the way we used to think. It's just that you clear the switchboard of letting the emotion of pleasure come through. It's as simple as that. You see, you can use an emotion and use it and use it and use it and use it, and all of a sudden, there's so much on that channel that has failed that your emotion is jammed. And so you're no longer monitoring that part of the switchboard self-determinedly. But the surrounding area is monitoring it for you. Or it's just jammed up and you feel like you can't feel anything about life anymore. Life doesn't look quite as bright to you as it looks. In short, the way to remedy this is just free up the emotions on a case. Very easy to do. You start running sympathy off parents, you'll get some of the most surprising results on cases. Surprising results. Fast. But the way, evidently, to trigger into emotion is to trigger into it on this curve, time when you felt happy, then you felt sad. And the fellow flounder around for a while, and all of a sudden you get hold of this one. It's just like he's just learned to wiggle his ears. Now he can run emotion. And he'll keep on, he can run emotion then. You straighten up a case, you get the sympathy off of it, you get these curves off, you'll find the service facsimile. If you can't get all the service facsimile off, just start pulling off sympathy all over the place. Lots of it. Pull off sympathy. You'll also get some agreement off. The next thing you know, the whole service facsimile chain will show up and you'll get the postulates where the guy and why he had to hold on to it and why he wanted to hold on to it. Now, if you find a person's persistence in life has gotten pretty poor, you just start running determinism and all of a sudden you'll find its curve. The curve where the person felt happy and excited about something, then less happy and excited, but he was getting determined. And then, he failed. So the next time he wasn't quite as determined. And the next time he wasn't quite as determined. The first thing you know, he's lost the emotion. Failure is designed as an incomplete cycle of action. Incomplete cycle of action. A cycle can be held in abeyance and be unaberrative. But if a cycle is broken by failure, person is happy, he determines he's going to be happy all evening and somebody makes him sad suddenly. That's a broken cycle of action. When an individual has these break on him, time after time after time after time, he picks up more and more bad experiences in the past and bad things such as psychosomatic illness and so forth to explain why. For instance, it's a common one. Runs out of the house and determined to have a good time downtown, left the iron on. Explanation, I forgot. Nice mechanism, good explanation. But what a hideous thing to wish on yourself, a bad memory, just to explain to Joe Blow why you left an iron on. There was some kind of a lapse, though, of why you left the iron on. You search around, you'll probably find that you made a strong and steady postulate just before that to turn that iron on and work until you were finished with the ironing, and then partway through it, you suddenly decided that you were going to go downtown and have a good time. And you leave the iron on to complete the cycle of action that you postulated first. It hasn't anything to do with a bad memory. It has to do with incomplete cycles of action. You get the idea. Now, if you think of all the cars which you have had or run, and you determined that you were going to keep them and keep them up forevermore, if you made such postulates, of course you failed, because sooner or later the car broke down and you sold it. Incomplete or failed cycle of action, right there. And it will finally result with your being rather angry with any car you walk into, or apathetic about cars. Salesman walks up to you, he could sell you anything. You make determinations, and you put no time period on them. And you just take them literally. You see, the body is really terrifically obedient. And so is your mind and thought processes. You've got horsepower. But if everybody has kept coming around to you saying, well, actually, we experiment on dogs and rats because it's so much like human beings. And it's really just a stimulus-response mechanism, and all thinking is done by association. You think of this, then that associates with something else, and that associates with something else. And you've got to adapt yourself to the environment, and you've got to make yourself a social animal, and we've got to punish you until you are social, you animal. You'll keep falling for this bag of tricks. Sitting right behind all of this terribly black curtain is the actual truth is that you're a powerhouse. And you keep on running as such, unfortunately, disconnected. And you keep laying down these postulates sweepingly. I dare say if a person really cleared up on this and he said, I think I will have four legs, he'd probably grow them. You know, when you realize what you can do to yourself, certainly the sky is the limit. The way to fix up a person is to deny that he's self-determined, tell him he has no willpower and this and that and a few other things. Give him standard child and school training, in other words. It doesn't cut him to pieces. except on his belief about himself. And right behind that belief, he keeps running like a skyrocket. And he says he's going to do something. Why, he's made a postulate there. And you might as well try to contain the explosion of an atom bomb in an inverted cup. It just couldn't be done because it's effective. Now, of all things, they teach people how to hypnotize themselves. This is wonderful, self-hypnosis. They fix a guy up so that he can hypnotize himself and tell himself to do things. Well, boy, this is certainly putting a coat of red paint on the guilt, which is already paint. Because that's silly. You're in complete rapport with yourself anyway. I mean, you do whatever you say you'll do. No matter what you think about it, you afterwards do what you say you will do, but now you'll have to change the thought in order to keep from doing what you say you do. The only person you're at war with is you. Now you go back and think of the times, for instance, when you decided this and decided that and decided something else. Think of this one. When did you decide not to be angry anymore? When did you decide not to show your temper anymore? You remember telling yourself this? I won't get mad anymore. You remember telling yourself, it's no use anyway? Remember telling yourself, I'll never get any place? Wonderful holder. All of these various postulates are very effective. If you want to really start showing up in life and throwing your shoulders back and being 9.5 feet tall, all you've got to do is, one, figure on it for a while until you realize that you're making your own postulates, that you are doing it to yourself. Or, two, sweep back just by sitting down and remembering a few times some of the postulates you have made surrounding certain incidents, surrounding certain actions. Now you could make a list of 10 things, the 10 things that you think are wrong with you, five of which are mental inabilities or foibles, and five of which are physical disabilities. And just start over this list of remembering the postulates you have made about each one in turn until you pick up the first time you wish them on yourself. Pick up that postulate. You'll find it. You could even sit there and run some emotional curves on yourself if you wanted to. Until you have picked up when you actually wanted these things or postulated that these things were necessary. Areas of your life will open like a steam shovel mouth. It's quite an adventure finding out that you are really running you after all. Now you can think also of a number of things which you feel compelled to do, like salesmen. You feel compelled to do something about something or other. When something happens in your environment, you feel compelled to act in a certain way. When somebody says something, makes some noise, disagrees with something, you feel compelled to act in a certain way. In other words, you feel compelled to agree somehow or other with the environment by reacting. Well, this is very interesting. All you've got to do is find out when you desired to act that way. When did you want to? When did you think it necessary to? You'll find that it immediately follows, if these things are really non-survival, you'll find that it immediately follows a failure of yours. If you want to get rid of the failure, just run the emotion out of it. The emotion of being happy, cheerful, everything going along all right, then being determined you're going to succeed and then failing. The emotion of failure, just run that curve. You'll disclose these things like mad. There's a little manual coming out called Advanced Procedure and Axioms. The axioms are brought up to date with the numbers they will probably continue to have from here on, with some new axioms of logic, and with co-auditing processing, as it is to date, in 15 steps, so that what the auditor has to do is just finish one step completely before he goes on to the next, and get each step done. When he gets through to and finishes step 15, he's through with the case. He can't do any. He could probably do a lot more with the case, but he'll have this case up too high to be recognized as a human being anyhow, so. Long about Friday, just to get speed off so that we would have these things as a manuals by, they're being run off, it's about 50 pages, but it's being run off on Mimeo, just so it's in time before it gets obsolete. Well, I sincerely hope that you'll give this matter a little thought on what you can do to yourself and what this thing called emotion is. See if you can't recapture one of these emotional curves, feeling happy, feeling sad. It's quite an adventure, by the way, finding out that you do it. And in view of the fact that this is a tenet which has not been held by anybody that I know of, except mothers, you did it to yourself. Now it's your fault. It should, by postulate, make a considerable change in the happiness and freedom of an individual. And by actual experiment, it makes a fantastic change in them. You'll find out sooner or later as you run this thing that you'll trigger some real secondaries sooner or later on it. But a person goes up pretty high. You run a minimal amount of effort, but effort is really something. You can do quite a bit of effort, but you don't have to do very much with the effort if you can desensitize by running the emotion. All right.